The weekend just behind us with inauguration celebrations and protest demonstrations shows the passions many of us possess for the future of the country. But this is far from the only time people show such passions. Our guest this hour traveled across the country talking to people who see the issues facing the country and have taken steps to address those issues in their own hometowns. Sarah Van Gelder is the traveler and the author of The Revolution Where You Live. Sarah Van Gelder is the co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine. That's Yes with an exclamation point, designed to do more than cover the stories of our time, but to suggest positive ways forward on the issues. Sarah's work history includes stints as a community organizer, radio and television producer, food co-op founder, and classical Indian dancer. So long resume, Sarah Van Gelder. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
This trip sounds like a very Yes Magazine thing to do, but I wanted to point out right up front, it was not in response to the election by a long shot.
No, we took off before the election. This was in response to our upcoming 20th anniversary. We've been writing for 20 years about what people were doing in their own communities to take on issues like climate change, to take on inequality, and what they were doing beyond that at a national level as well. And I just felt like as we were approaching that 20th anniversary, I just felt like, you know what, we need to find out, are these really working and are there other solutions out there? Because some of these issues are getting worse, not better. So is there something we're missing? And it seemed like the way to find out was to go out and look for myself, and especially to go out and look in the places that aren't normally covered in the media, that are invisible, or they're at the margins of society. So that's why I drove and why I spent 4 months moving slowly around the country.
And 12,000 miles altogether, isn't that right?
That's right, yep.
So you write in the book that isolation is making people depressed, sick, and powerless. There are so many of us now, more than 300 million, and we have Facebook. But people still feel isolated, though, huh?
That's right. Facebook is not a substitute for actual human contact. There's some really interesting science on that. It actually does not increase our sense of empathy or our sense of connection. It's almost like what junk food does. It fools our body into thinking we're getting nutrition, but we're really not. So, yeah, the research shows that many of us have fewer people we trust than was the case, say, a generation ago. And the research also shows that isolation can be as toxic as smoking cigarettes.
Wow, truly. So Sarah, what would you say is the biggest single reason you found that people say they feel the country is on the wrong track?
Well, I think the biggest thing for a lot of people was a sense of being excluded from the economy, from the wealth that seems to continue to flow in our economy. We keep hearing the story from the Obama administration about how much he brought the economy back and how much unemployment is going down and so forth. And that's all true. He inherited an economy that was in terrible shape and brought it back from the brink of real disaster. But there are still so many people left out. So many people who can't find a job are saddled with enormous debt, or if they can find a job, they're working several low-wage jobs just to make ends meet. So the sense of pervasive insecurity and a sense that nobody's really hearing just how scary it is out here, that sense was pretty widespread, you know, whether it was in the small rural communities that have been hollowed out as corporate agriculture has displaced farmers, whether it's in urban neighborhoods that have had double-digit unemployment for years and where young people are more likely to go to prison than they are to get a good-paying job with benefits. All across the country, there's all sorts of different kinds of circumstances, but I think just way too many people are feeling that they're just left out, and in fact, they're right. And most of the benefits of economic growth over the past decades have gone to the top 1%. So it's not just an illusion. It's really true.
But when you talk about revolution, I mean, this is not just to make a catchy title. I mean, you truly do believe a revolution is underway?
I believe there's signs of it and there are possibilities. So this was before the travel I did was when the Trump candidacy was still in the early stages. But there was clear signs of the discontent then, and we're seeing it even more so with both the massive support for Bernie Sanders as well as the support for Donald Trump. The status quo really isn't working for people, and they're willing to try some pretty radical alternatives, some of which I think are pretty bad ideas, to try something new because they're so fed up with the status quo. So, yeah, I think people are ready for a revolution, and I think the question is what sort of revolution? It could be a catastrophic one. It could be one that actually builds democracy from the bottom up, from the grassroots up, and that was what I was looking for signs of, that people in their own communities are taking their own future into their hands and creating a different kind of society from the bottom up, which is a society that I trust a lot more than one that comes from the top down.
Well, yeah, since you stayed with politics, let me hang in there for a moment, too. How do we get, then, I wonder, from a power to the people movement electing an only I can do it president?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it built on a huge amount of fake news. It built on interference from the Russian oligarchs, of all things. I think when you talk to people who voted for Trump, a lot of them were saying things like, well, I don't know if this is going to work, but I don't care. I don't care if we kind of smash the whole thing down, which is, I think, a really unfortunately nihilistic way of thinking about our country. It's really unfortunate, but I think that level of desperation is what we were seeing.
Sort of like tearing things down to build them back up again?
Right, and it's not a position I advocate. I think there's way too much risk in taking apart our basic institutions that are providing us with education and healthcare, even if inadequately. Then I would much rather see us rebuild from the bottom up than just tear things down without really having an idea of what to substitute.
We'll move on from politics and get more into the specifics of Sarah Van Gelder's 12,000-mile journey across the United States. She put together the book, The Revolution Where You Live. We'll come back and talk more with Sarah and take phone calls and emails from you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sarah Van Gelder, the co-founder and now editor-at-large of Yes Magazine, Yes with an exclamation point, all about not just journalism, but looking for positive solutions to things that ail the country. She took a long trip, 12,000 miles across the United States, looking for stories of people who've been doing things on the forgotten edges of society and places you never hear of and societies you never hear much from. Their book is called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange for questions or comments about the process. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go way back, Sarah, because the itinerary really begins with you, 7 years old in India. What questions did your experiences there raise about life in the United States?
Well, I grew up in a small town in Maryland, and my family, my father was a professor, my family was on exchange in India, and suddenly I encountered a whole different world. The story I tell in the book is about going with my family to have a picnic out on a open hillside, and as we spread out our blankets and our food, realizing there was a whole group of children watching us, and realizing that those children were probably hungry, and they didn't have what I had. And that struck me at the time as wrong and deeply wrong, and I didn't understand why that should be the case, but I felt like that I wanted to understand that better, and I wanted to do something about it, because even though I didn't feel like I could feed every child in that circle or every child who was begging for food when we went out on the street, I felt like I needed to understand the systems that could create that kind of hardship.
And as you take the story back home, the heart of all this is wondering why we tolerate poverty and suffering. Do you have a solid answer for that yet?
Well, I think it goes back to the stories. We tell ourselves stories about how our society works that help us to reconcile those kinds of things. And unfortunately, I think part of the story that we tell ourselves in the United States to justify that kind of injustice is a racist story. It's a story that somehow people who are black or brown somehow don't deserve what white people have. And I think that was part, of course, what Trump was building on, was that illusion that somehow there's anything fundamentally different about who we are and what rights we have to sustenance. So,
you describe yourself, though, as a reluctant activist. What finally pulled you in?
In my own community, I was living on an Indian reservation outside Seattle, and I had just moved into this community, and my neighbors knocked on the door and said, we have to stay united against the tribe. And I didn't know what they were talking about. I had just moved in. But the idea that we would be united against the tribe when we were living on their land just struck me as impossible. And I went to a local meeting at a church and learned that the neighbors were very upset that the tribe wanted to build housing on the same street where they lived. And as a mainly white affluent community, they didn't want to see that happen. So I spoke up in favor of the tribe's right to build housing for their own members. And then shortly after that, when Chief Seattle's grave was desecrated and no one said anything about it, I ended up forming with some tribal elders, forming an organization to try to change the dynamics in that community, to try to build more understanding, build bridges. And over the course of a number of years, we did some really interesting things. One of them is we got the land where Chief Seattle had lived, where the largest longhouse in the region had been located. We got that land returned to the tribe. So we did some great work together, and it's been just one of the most rewarding parts of my life. Is even though I kind of, as an introvert, I kind of preferred to stay home and not get involved in something as conflicted as this relationship that had been going on for years before I got there with the tribe. When it came down to it, when somebody actually knocked on my door and I realized I had to get involved, I am so glad I did, because it's been a really rewarding part of my life.
And it is from the Port Madison Indian Reservation that you set out on your journey across the country. How did you choose vehicle and itinerary?
Well, I chose a vehicle that that I could camp in, so I got a little camper to put on the bed of the pickup truck. And the itinerary, I wanted to go to the places that are at the margins of society that maybe aren't quite as hooked into the reward system of the status quo and see what kinds of things people are creating there. So because I started from the Northwest, of course, I was going to start by exploring the region immediately to my east. And that turned out to be Montana, North Dakota, where there was a bunch of work being done on resisting fossil fuel extraction. And then I headed from there to the Midwest, and then the South, and then back around to the Southwest.
Sarah Van Gelder is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her journey across the country of 12,000 miles is related in the book, The Revolution Where You Live. So you did refine your mission a bit before you left to get down to some certain specific questions you wanted to ask people. What ultimately did you ask about?
Well, the three big questions that I was looking for were, what are people doing about the climate crisis and the related issues around fossil fuel extraction? So what can we do about that at a local level? Because on the national and international level, we're making some progress, but it's way too slow. So that was one. The second was the question of inequality. If we have such a problem with inequality in these large areas of the country that are marginalized, who's building a different kind of economy in their own communities, building on local business and local talent? And the third was about racism, because it is such a pervasive issue in our country. Some people hoped that with the election of an African-American president, we could put that behind us, but that is clearly not what has happened. And I wanted to find out if, just like in our community, we had done some really productive work on the question of racism directed against the tribe. And I was curious to see if other communities should take in on that issue at a local level as well. So those were the three main topics I was looking at.
So the starting point, as you mentioned, Montana, not oil there, but coal. Who's trying to take it out, and what's the general run of the story?
Well, I discovered this story because just north of Seattle, the Lummi tribe had been fighting a large coal terminal that was going to be built to ship huge amounts of coal, the largest in the United States, huge amounts of coal to Asia. And the Lummi tribe didn't want it because it was going to destroy their fisheries and really affect their way of life. So they had been fighting it. And I just asked myself, so where is all that coal coming from? It turns out that there was a proposed mine in southeast Montana, a place called Otter Creek Valley. And so I traveled there. I got in my truck, and that was one of the first places I went, and discovered it was this beautiful valley. You know, I didn't really know much about the southeast part of Montana. I thought maybe this is all wasteland. Maybe nobody cares. But it's not the case at all. In fact, I really didn't find any place that nobody cared about. But this is a lovely valley right adjacent to the Custer National Forest. It's ranched by people who've been ranching that land for generations. It's right adjacent to the Northern Cheyennes Reservation. And they're very, very upset about it as well. And so I got to witness this group of ranchers and this group of Native people with the help of a smattering of environmentalists who've been working for years to try to keep this mine from being dug. It would have been the largest coal mine in the entire state of Montana, which is a state that is full of mines. And for both groups of people, I was actually there when there was a ceremony. There was the people from Lummi, from the coast, had brought a totem pole that they carved to Southeast Montana as a gift to the Northern Cheyenne people. So there's this wonderful ceremony that just happened to be when I was there of the Lummi tribe, the Northern Cheyenne tribe, local ranchers, all celebrating the arrival of this totem pole and all speaking to why they wanted to protect their land and water from this huge new coal mine. And I was so struck by how much they had in common. You know, I thought, you know, maybe they're just barely able to tolerate each other's presence because they had to for this particular campaign. But they both spoke about the deep feeling of the sacred responsibility that they have to the land and the water, which they inherited, and which they feel like they are responsible for passing along to future generations. You know, in both cases, for the ranchers, they'd been there for generations, and in the case of the tribe, it had been much, much longer. And the ranchers acknowledged that the native people had that much longer heritage on the land. But they had that in common, and it was so striking to me because they also said, you know, because we have this responsibility, we're willing to do the hard work. We're willing to read those 100-page long environmental assessments and travel to Helena, to the state capitol, to testify, or even to Washington, D.C. to testify, and we're willing to do this year after year if that's what it takes to protect this land. So there's something about that level of responsibility and commitment to place that just struck me as really powerful. And when they show up with their ranching cowboy hats and the native people show up and they all show up together, they have an impact. And in fact, it didn't happen while I was there. It happened after I got back. I learned that the coal company had eventually given up on that coal mine, that the folks had won, and the same thing happened with that coal terminal. The Lummi tribe won when the Army Corps of Engineers recognized that they had treaty rights to that fisheries, and that made that coal terminal impossible.
So no mine, no terminal, no railroad to get to the mine either.
No new railroad. There's still the existing railroad that is shipping coal from other sources.
Mm-hmm. But not this new spur that would have gone in there. Yeah. We're talking to Sarah Van Gelder, the co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine, Yes with an exclamation point. She toured the country to get a talk to people who are really sort of on the margins of society about ways they are trying to make sure the world is a better place. The book is called The Revolution Where You Live. Let's take a call from Skeeter and Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hiya, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Sarah, thank you for a great program. Maybe we can go back to politics just for a minute. I called last week and I was hoping that people, now that we're in the age of Trump, I'm hoping that people will become involved with the Democratic Party to try to reform it, become very active in it, help and develop a progressive agenda for the future, really focusing on the 2018 elections. And my question is I'm curious, as you went around the country, did you detect much political involvement where people were actually becoming precinct people and helping to develop progressive agendas in their areas? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Skeeter. Appreciate that.
Well, first of all, I totally agree with you. In fact, I've got a column that I'm drafting right now that will be in the next issue of Yes. It's basically about the role that the Democratic Party needs to take if it wants to be relevant again. So I totally agree with you on that question. As far as what I saw, I was there before the election campaign was really taking off. And as you know, in a lot of communities, it's only right before the presidential campaigns that people really get involved, which I think is really unfortunate because I do think we need independent political activism that happens, all year round, all throughout the election cycle. So no, I didn't find a lot of that. What I did find was people who were engaged in their communities in a way that wasn't so political. They were more, and frankly, this is what I was looking for as well. They were creating the kind of community that they wanted without waiting for elected officials to either help or hinder. So that's not to say that I don't think politics is important. I think it's incredibly important in the policies that we're going to be seeing coming down from Donald Trump, I'm terribly concerned about. So I'm not suggesting that we just take for granted that things are going to be okay in Washington, D.C. while we work on our communities. But I do think there's a level in our communities when we come together, when we really work together well, we can also do a lot to hold our elected officials accountable. So then it's not just, every 4 years we'll try to get the right person in office. It's, you know, every day, what are you doing to forward the agenda that we, the people, have asked you to forward?
So we started with Montana and coal and efforts to get coal out of the ground. You went off to North Dakota and the Bakken oil field, and I gather you actually smelled it a bit before you knew you were there.
That's right. The air there is so smoggy. There's so many of these fracking wells, and they're flaring off the natural gas. So they're just flaring. They're just wasting it, which is filling the valleys, you know, with this smog. So, yeah, it was quite striking to go from the. Well, it was cleaner air in Montana, although there were all these wildfires that summer, and
all right.
That was creating this smoke in the air. So, it was actually sort of bizarre because I kept thinking I'm going to be going places where it's really clean air because it's this wide open territory, and yet with climate change we're seeing so many more fires now, and that was happening that summer.
In North Dakota, in the oil fields, the numbers that you cite here are pretty amazing about how quickly and how big the oil industry has gotten in the Dakotas.
It has. It's been, you know, it's been lauded as this wonderful source of American energy independence, and yet it's the wrong kind of energy independence. It's based on, once again, rebuilding that fossil fuel economy, when what we need to be doing, what 90%, close to 90% of Americans want, is a massive new investment in renewables. So, yes, it's growing like crazy. And, you know, the thing about booms as well as busts is they bring lots of problems. So in Fort Berthold, which is a place I visited, a reservation I visited right in the middle of this oil boom, they have these huge man camps, they call them, where workers from all over are come and go. And because there's no real connection to one another or to the place, they don't feel that sense of responsibility. And crime rates are really high, and human trafficking and drug trafficking, a lot of money, very little sense of, you know, connection or responsibility. And then all that money is creating corruption issues for the tribe. There's a lot of toxic waste being dumped. It's just become really quite a nightmare for the people who are living there. So then when I had a chance to visit another tribe, I was really excited to find out that they had taken a really different path. I went to the Turtle Mountain Chippewa tribe in the northern part of North Dakota and interviewed a young woman who had been called, along with some other women, by an elder to check into this question of fracking, because the elder said, you know, fracking seems to be headed our direction. Is this something we want? Is this going to be good for us? And she and the other women did some research and decided that, no, it was absolutely not what they wanted. It could jeopardize the quality of their water, and they're very proud of their beautiful, pristine lakes and aquifers. And it could bring in all those social issues that Fort Berthold has been experiencing. So they decided they absolutely did not want to bring fracking in. They brought it to the tribal council. Tribal council held a community meeting and voted unanimously to ban fracking. And when I was there, I had a chance to interview the tribal chairman and asked him, you know, how do you feel about this? Was this a good choice to basically leave millions of dollars on the table? And he said, you know, I've been watching what's happening over there in Fort Berthold, and when they say money doesn't buy happiness, I think they're right. And then he said, I believe in making money the old-fashioned way, you know, and he's a small business owner, and he just doesn't see that all those millions flooding into his community would have done any good. And in fact, as I was leaving, I noticed that at the community college they have a brand new windmill there, and learned when I did some more research that's become their major focus. They're going to be developing the abundant wind energy that the plains have. You know, they have so much wind.
Yeah, it does come whistling through there, sure.
That's right.
So you say, though, that, I mean, it's clear that the energy industry, nobody needed to tell anybody before this book that it's very rich and powerful, but you say that local communities have more power than they know. In what sense?
Well, I think it goes back to that sense of authority over place. If you say, this is where I'm from, this is where we're from, we have this relationship to this place, we understand what's valuable here, we care about the water. Just like the people at Standing Rock have been doing with their stand in terms of the quality of their water. And you say, that's what's important, and we're not going to back down. That's a powerful stand. It's not that you always win. Certainly people in all across the country are trying to fight fracking, and sometimes they have not prevailed. But it does have a powerful presence.
We are talking to Sarah Van Gelder about her book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. She did, in fact, travel that far, and not just to remote parts of the West, but to remote parts of the East as well, often to the Rust Belt and into cities like Newark, New Jersey, long depressed, long blighted, but we'll find out the kinds of things that she learned there about the ways in which people are seeing a future that is brighter than the one they have at the moment. You'll join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We will take a short break and come back and talk more with Sarah and take your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sarah Van Gelder, longtime journalist, co-founder, and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine with an exclamation point. She traveled across the country in search of people on the margins of society looking for ways to make society better. Her book is called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. This is a conversation you're welcome to join at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I hasten to add this was a year before the election campaigns, and so, yes, there were some of the same issues touched upon, the same feelings in the country, but not directly tied necessarily to the political process. Sarah, you were just talking about the sense of place, though, where people can say, hey, look, this is our community. We don't want the coal taken out, or the oil or the gas taken out. Does it work in the other direction, though? I mean, if you get in a community like the ones where we live, where some people say, hey, look, it's our community, so what if it's a national forest? We do want the trees out. We do want the jobs. I mean, does that work in both directions?
Well, I think it can. I think there's a wonderful tradition. I didn't cover this in the book, but I think there is a wonderful tradition of community forestry where communities take responsibility for their forest and for how it can be managed so that it can both create livelihoods and be sustained in the long run. And some of those communities have done a terrific job because they know that if they manage it well, they won't be surrounded by clear cuts and they won't have flooding problems and soil erosion and all the other issues that go with that. They can have a way of life that can sustain them and their children for generations to come.
So off to the Rust Belt now. I mean, you see the industries that moved out of the Rust Belt of the country, taking their jobs with them as extractive. And you don't mean in the sense of like extraction industries like coal and oil. What do you mean here by extractive?
What I'm talking about is a kind of an economy that basically takes everywhere it can and does so for the benefit of the people at the, basically the investors and the executives, for a small group of people who as a result get very wealthy, but leave behind some real issues. So, for example, a community can be extractive in terms of its labor force. It takes what the labor force has to offer, you know, for whatever pay it has to pay. But if another labor force is offering to do the same work for less, it has no loyalty to the people who have been devoting their lives to that company. And if they can find a way to even take the pensions that those workers earned and turn them into profits, they have been known to do that. So that's a form of an economy that I think is based on the Wall Street system of extracting maximum profit from wherever you go, which is really different than, for example, a small business type of ethos, which is, you know, is businesses that are run in a community by people who realize that they want a good way of life. They want their schools to function, and they want water that they can drink and air they can breathe. And so they have a lot of different relationships to the place where their business is located. It's not just an extractive one. And I think we really have to get away from that extractive economy. I think it's causing way too much damage. And we have to learn how to do the other one better. We've had that tradition in this country for a long time. We've always had, you know, farmers who raise crops sustainably, and we've always had small business owners who care about their local communities. But we've allowed this extractive economy to become so dominant and so powerful that it actually drives out the more connected, more generative kind of economy.
And you have some examples of the smaller businesses that are doing the kinds of things that you're talking about here, like New Era Windows that you found in the Rust Belt. Tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, so they're located in Chicago. They were originally a small factory, and the owners decided to close the factory and sell out, and I guess they were going to move abroad, but they neglected to pay the workers the wages that they were due as they closed, and so the workers occupied the factory, and eventually, through intervention from people in politics and the union and so forth, eventually the company was sold to another company. But this time the workers were a little bit wondering whether that was going to happen again. And they found out about this idea of worker ownership. And so this time when the company threatened to close down, they occupied again and managed to win the right to buy the company. So now they own it. Now these people who had been the factory workers own the company themselves. They have a very different way of thinking about it. They don't have to make as big a profit, because they don't have to pay these huge executive salaries. They don't have to return money to a Wall Street bank. They just have to make enough to be able to pay their loans, to pay themselves, to pay for the, you know, for what the business needs, to reinvest in the business. And that means that there's a sense of being able to keep producing something that's needed, windows and doors in this case, energy efficient windows and doors, and to keep jobs locally. And those are the priorities instead of returning money to a distant investor. And it's so interesting talking to the worker owners there, because they say, you know, back before, we used to have an idea of how production could be done better, but the bosses really weren't interested in our ideas. They just told us to do it their way. Now when we see a way to do things better, we talk it over together, and we can just do it. So it's a really different way of thinking about it, and it's an idea I think a lot of people appreciate, especially people who have been felt like they would never have an ownership stake in the economy, that they were never going to have the wherewithal to be able to own their own business. But as part of a worker ownership model cooperative, they can own a piece of it, and they can have some democratic control over the circumstances of their work life.
You see this as ultimately more sustainable than the stock ownership situation with the really large corporations we have now?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think the way that stock system works is that everyone is in competition with everybody else to get the most cash flowing to the most wealthy people. And we already have extraordinary levels of inequality. We have something like 20 individuals who own more wealth than like half of the families in the United States. I mean, that becomes just so divisive and so toxic for our entire society. That kind of inequality just distorts our government. It means that there isn't that sense of solidarity of working for the common good. There's so many ways in which that really undermines the meaning of a society that can work. And on the other hand, people in America, I think, are very devoted to the idea that small businesses and business, you know, that we all should have an opportunity to have a stake in our economy. Well, we need to be able to do that without having big corporations that can come and just wipe us out, because they have so much more power than we do, and they can take advantage of the taxes. You know, small businesses actually pay into these tax funds that then provide subsidies for big corporations. We just need to flip that on its head. We need to start supporting our locally rooted businesses, whether they're cooperatives or mom and pop kinds of businesses, or whether they're owned by our local government.
Let's take a call. We have Kara and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sarah Van Gelder. And her book is The Revolution Where You Live. Hi, Kara.
Oh, and hi, Sarah. Yeah, so you're talking about these extractive industries that chew up and spit out people, working class and middle class people, when they're done with them. And those people are of all races. And so white people that have gone through that, they've also been dehumanized by that experience of being degraded and losing their jobs and losing their incomes and their homes, and they're alienated, and you might have seen some of this. I'm just wondering, it seems like that experience of suffering is similar to what inner city people and immigrant people who don't have resources also suffer. It's this common experience of suffering at this kind of extractive capitalism. Do you see any opportunities for finding a new common ground on this issue of solidarity and a common experience of suffering and this kind of capitalism, but in a new way?
Yes, I do. I think that kind of experience is very much one that we have in common, and I do think that the Bernie coalition was, Bernie Sanders supporters, was a coalition that did make that link. That said, I think it's also really important to understand that the experience of people of color is fundamentally different in some respects. Because of the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, black families have not had an opportunity to build assets at the same rate as white families. And the recession in 2008 doubled the gap between white families and black families. Because, you know, if you have an opportunity to pass along wealth generation by generation, then one family, even if it's not a lot of wealth, even if it's just the opportunity to go to college, those things benefits white folks in a way that people of color have not been able to benefit from. And an awful lot of African Americans, their homes were basically their only assets if they had their own home. And so many of them were subject to predatory lending and lost their homes during that recession. So I think we have to understand both the similarities and the places where people of color have been particularly excluded from this economy. And we just need to keep acknowledging that and keep putting that in our thinking as we think about how the solutions can work and as we think about who can provide the right kind of leadership to take us to the next economy.
Kara, thanks for that question. Sarah, you headed for the heart of Appalachian coal country, and the rest of the country was shocked to learn how poor it was more than 50 years ago. Is it worse now?
It's worse in some ways. It's worse in the sense that a lot of jobs have gone away, and there's a sense of hopelessness about the coal economy. Well, the jobs went away, you know, partly because of the environmental reasons that the people in Appalachia, like the Republican politicians, like to blame, but also because of automation. So now there's a lot of that mining is taking place through blowing off the tops of mountains, and they use big machineries, and they use fewer actual laborers to do the work. So for all sorts of reasons, there's a bunch of coal jobs that just no longer exist. In fact, there's if you look at where the growth is in jobs, it's really in renewable energy. So as much as the politicians might like to say that the coal jobs are coming back, they really are not going to come back. So yeah, there's a lot of hopelessness there. There's also a group of young people that I met in Whitesburg, Kentucky, who are working together to rethink what the economy of that region can be like, understanding that coal isn't coming back. Also not going along with the idea that prisons is the new economic development strategy for places like Kentucky. They're talking about how do you build on the strengths of this region, which include the incredible culture, the music, the quilting, the art. People are really interested in that authentic culture that still exists there in Appalachia. How do you revive a nightlife, the cultural center that many parts of Appalachia were? And it's so interesting to see what they're doing. To see one of the things in Whitesburg is they ended a prohibition on selling liquor in restaurants and bars, which meant that they could then have nightlife and they could bring in live music. And then people started visiting because they wanted to participate in that live music. And they have a different kind of an economic development strategy in that town.
Ada Smith, is she one of the people involved with that? I loved her story because she left, she missed it, she returned despite, in her words, how messed up it was, but came back.
That's right. Yes, she is one of the people that I interviewed, and yes, she grew up in that area and feels also sort of offended that so many people make these assumptions about people from Appalachia. She's a young person, a lesbian, and yet people who met her when she was traveling and when she was going to college, they all assume she must be a racist and a homophobe, and she is not any of those things. In fact, one of the things I love about her story is that she's part of a radio station that broadcasts to that whole mountain region, and they were aware that many of their listeners were people in the penitentiaries. There's something like 7 jails and penitentiaries in their listening area. And so they have a hip-hop program every Monday night called Hip Hop from the Hilltop that she's one of the DJs for. And one day they got a phone message from somebody who was trying to reach one of the inmates. And they realized there was a real demand for some kind of way of communicating with people who are in those isolated prisons. And so what they started doing is recording every Monday for 2 hours. They record messages for the people who are behind bars. And then they play them for an hour straight, nothing but one shout-out after the next, mainly from Midwest cities to people who have loved ones behind bars. And those kinds of the messages are anything from, you know, your niece had a baby, to, you know, keep your head up, we're thinking about you, to, you know, just we love you. And it's been kind of a revelation, I think, for the local community to hear that, that those are actual human beings behind bars who have people who love them and who care about them. And I was so impressed that these young DJs had the compassion to realize that that was a bridge that needed to be made.
Just about a minute left here, and you seem to gravitate to people who are optimistic, in some cases very cautiously so. How do they seem to maintain hope, even though reality is going to knock them down a lot?
Well, it's true that there's a lot of things to be worried about, but there's something about when you get out of your comfort zone and go out and work with people and be with people and do things together that is just really enlivening. I found so many places where people were literally full of joy, whether that was Detroit, Michigan, or, you know, the farm I visited outside Louisville, Kentucky. It just brings about so much joy when people have that opportunity to work together.
There's a lot of uplift in the book, despite, in some cases, some fairly grim circumstances. Sarah Van Gelder is the co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine, the author of The Revolution Where You Live, stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.